Well, you can all tell that the sound system is installed. People who are out there beyond this room will hear the tape in 2 or 3 weeks. Hopefully you will see a difference. It's not completely installed. We've mixed new sound wine in old sound bottles, I guess, and we have to be sure that it's all put together the way we need it to be. But at least you see the speakers are up, and we have a lot of new equipment back there. Sound is very, very important in helping feed the flock properly. I have a couple of articles here. Some of you may have noticed the front page of your papers in Akron, Beacon Journal, about 5 days ago on the 14th, had a headline entitled NATO Troops Battle Snipers. Maybe some of you saw the article. I don't know if other papers had it, but it was an Associated Press article, probably was in other places. Interestingly enough, 8 days earlier in the Akron Beacon Journal, there was a special article entitled Marine Sniper in Vietnam Comes to Terms with Past, end of quote. And the article is what I guess I would call Lessons from a Sniper. Now, a sniper is somebody who sits in a place far away, protected with a high-powered rifle that is telescopically lined up in such a way that he can kill people who have no idea they're about to die and do it from great distances. The fellow about whom this article is written is a guy by the name of Chuck Mawinney, and he apparently was one of the best snipers that, United States military the history has ever seen. And he talks about some of the various rules of sniping. Let me give you a little bit of it. As macabre and awful as the article is, there are lessons in it for all of us. He has one rule: never look in their eyes. Even in the age of million-dollar computer-driven missiles, the ability of one man to kill another with a 20-cent bullet is a much-prized skill among military forces. In the ugliness of war, the sniper is assigned to harass, intimidate, and demoralize the enemy, make them afraid to venture into the open, and deny them the chance to rest and regroup. In other words, if you were going to just sort of put it in a nutshell, it's try to devastate through emotional, psychological mayhem and confusion the minds of your enemies. That would be my quote. On the wall of the Marine Sniper School at Camp Pendleton is a Chinese proverb: kill one man, terrorize a thousand, end of quote. Now, that's the goal of a sniper, just demoralize. Once I had a Charlie, he says, that's a slang for Vietnam Kong soldiers, in my scope, was my job to kill him before he killed me, said this guy who's 51 years old. Well, I'm 51 years old. I look at this man and I say, that could be me. I never looked in their eyes. I never stopped to think about whether the guy had a wife or kids. Mawinney was routinely a deadly shot from a distance of 300 to 800 yards. He could put a little piece of lead in somebody from well over a half a mile away. Sometimes, over 1,000 yards, he could pick a spot on somebody's head and hit the exact spot on their head from 1,000 yards. Now, a mile is 1,760 yards. It was the ultimate hunting trip, he says. A man hunting another man who was hunting me. Don't talk to me about hunting lions or elephants. They don't fight back with rifles and scopes. I just loved it. I ate it up. And then he talks about practice made perfect. So what changed his mind about never rehashing Vietnam? He decided to come out and talk about snipers, first because anonymity was no longer an option. He was discovered. He decided he could help change the public image of snipers as bloodthirsty assassins. A good sniper, Mawinney said, saves more lives than he takes because he undercuts the enemy's will or ability to fight. So, they put a nice spin on it. It's It's sort of the way the United States goes to war, saying they're making the world safe for democracy. Sounds lofty and noble. In the end result, it's a justification for killing a lot of people in a variety of ways. The enemy put a bounty on his head because he was so good, and all snipers carried a sidearm with a round to fire into their temple rather than be captured. He was the son of World War II marksman himself, and he received at graduation from marksman school a little red book that purported to be the complete sniper's manual. Inside was a single admonition on page one, and it simply said, "Thou shalt kill." That was their mindset. He learned to gauge distance, moisture, weather, and terrain, and various other factors that determine how much a bullet will rise or drop during flight. And he had the patience to wait hours for the right shot. He said he was scared but exhilarated. "Normally I would shoot and run, but if I had them at a long distance, I wasn't worried. I would shoot and then lay there and wait and wait and wait, and pretty soon somebody else would start moving toward the body. Then I'd shoot and kill again." End of quote. He hit 16 in one incident, all in the head while they were crossing a stream. The idea is catch them in water and they can't move as fast. And it's considered, Hall of Fame-like precision to be able to kill 16 enemy from great distance, all headshots in one incident. But he said, "I didn't get credited with the kills because they were only probables. Nobody was there. You need an officer to confirm it." Then he talks about how they would drop, and sometimes they'd never move. Sometimes they'd cry out. And he said, "I always tried to make sure I killed them if they dropped. And they were still alive. I felt I owed it to them to put them out of their misery." And he said one of the rationales and instruction he was given is that wasn't a man you just killed. It was an enemy, and there's a difference. This is our job. This is what war is all about. If you mess up, you die, and so forth. And then it goes on to talk about the nightmares he has of having killed over 300 people that he knew of, and over 100 of them were confirmed, and then he doesn't know how many others died because of wounds. One sniper from those kinds of distances could kill that kind of numbers. Stunning. There is a great sniper out there, and I guess we can learn lessons from this sniper about that sniper. I think you know who that sniper is. Now, that said, I want to change gears a bit. There's an old saying, you have to pay the piper. The Apostle Paul in Galatians 6 and verse 7 probably put it differently, but really said the same thing. You might turn over there. Galatians 6 and verse 7. "Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man sows, that shall he reap." I've often enjoyed the famous Paul Harvey quote, "Most people sow wild oats all week and then go to church on Sunday and pray for a crop failure." Because they don't want their crop to come in. They want to sow one kind of seed and reap a beautiful crop of something very different and much better. That's just people. Proverbs 26 and verse 2. And another verse in Proverbs. Right near it, we'll read now. Proverbs 26 and verse 2. "As the bird by wandering, as the swallow to flying, so the curse, causeless, shall not come." In other words, you might say, eventually you pay the piper, or your chickens come home to roost. A bird, a swallow, might fly all over, but eventually they come home. If you're under a curse, there's a cause. So the curse that doesn't have a cause shall not come. There's always a cause why things happen. If somebody finds themselves saying, I'm sure in your life you probably heard yourself say, I just feel like I'm under a curse. If certain things go wrong in rapid succession, well, you probably aren't under a curse. But you know, people can bring a curse on themselves. The Bible does talk about doing certain things. A variety of things in the Bible bring a curse. Anybody who goes into a different gospel brings upon themselves a curse, the Bible says. If people rebel against God, God says He'll curse whole nations. He'll curse the womb. And you understand those verses. Mr. Armstrong talked about a thing called cause and effect. If you're getting a certain effect, if your chickens are coming home to roost, you find yourself paying the piper. If the crop's coming in, you better go back and look at the cause. Now, I haven't forgotten that we started this sermon talking about snipers. Don't necessarily guess that you know where I'm going with this. Look at Proverbs 28 and verse 13. He that covers his sins shall not prosper, but whoso confesses and forsakes them shall have mercy. Now, you can sow the wrong seed and come to recognize it, or you can try to cover it up. And ultimately, those sins will find you out. The Bible is very plain. Our sins will find us out. What we sow, we'll reap. Now let's change gears again, and let's turn to Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. And let's read a verse that we'll actually come back to a little bit later on. Ephesians 4 and verse 26. Be you angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. Neither give place to the devil. Neither give place to the devil. Now, you might stop and ask yourself, if you get angry and there's wrath involved, that's extreme anger, do you realize you're giving place to the devil? Most people might think, well, I got angry, but they don't realize verse 27 accompanies the condition of verse 26. Most people would little realize how serious, for instance, is anger and wrath. This is not a sermon about anger and wrath. But there are consequences to what people do. If you sow a certain thing, you're going to reap a certain thing. That's just God's law. I often used to hear Mr. Armstrong say, if you keep the law, it will keep you. If you break it, it will break you. Because, after all, it is a law. It's not something, the commandments and laws of God, they're not something that God sits up in heaven meeting out punishment all the time, or blessings, depending upon whether people are breaking or keeping his law. That isn't what he does. There are laws. There are automatic consequences that we could call effects that spring from certain causes. If people overspend, ultimately, they're going to go bankrupt. Now, it may take a long time, and it may depend on how much they overspend, or how little they have to spend. There may be a lot of reasons, but ultimately a person who's overspending, unchecked, given enough time, is going to go bankrupt. It's a fact. And then when they go bankrupt, they can't really ask, what's wrong? Because there was a cause. They were conducting their life a certain way. Let's shift gears again. Don't necessarily turn there unless you'd like to, but in the book of Job, there is this discussion between God and Satan. I've often described the book of Job as Satan attacked Job, his friends accused him, and God abased him. It's 42 chapters of the devil, Job's friends, and God all working on him. They all had different motives. But in the end, this great man of God was a far greater servant of God. Now you remember the beginning of the book, Job 1, where Satan is given permission to go down and have a limited impact that increased, but a limited impact on Job. And God says, okay, you can do this, but don't go further. You can do the other, but you can't go any further than that. Well, eventually Job lost virtually everything but his life. He lost his possessions, He lost his family, and for a period of time, because of the boils and sores, you'd have to say he lost his health. And of course he lost his friends. He did not lose God, but he had to go through this trial. Now I'm going to ask you a question. When Satan went down and began to address Job and afflicted him, would you say, now remember, Satan had God's permission. Would you say that the source of Job's trials were, ready, here we go, very basic question, was the source of his trials God or Satan? What would you say? God or Satan? Satan brought the trial, but God was in on it. That's just the fact of the story. Who was the source of Job's problem? Do you know the answer is it makes absolutely no difference? Because whatever you go through in life, you have to pass the test anyway. And I've long said, Satan tempts people in the hope that they will fail, but in fact, God tests people in the hope that they will succeed. Either way, regardless of what is in the mind of the person who is doing it, whether it's God, man, or the devil, you have to pass the test. And if you don't pass the test, if there are weaknesses in your life that are left unaddressed, whether they are tempted by the devil, whether you're accused by men or tested by God, ultimately, if you don't address them, what you sow, you reap. What you do in your life will come back to you. It just will. The curse, causeless, will not come. God saw fundamental problems in Job. He knew that Satan couldn't go any further than he was going to let him go, and that was it. And God allowed Satan, ultimately, while thinking he was hurting Job, to help him. So the devil plays a part in God's plan. He can only go as far as either God or we allow him. Satan is God's tool. God allows him because we, this is if Satan attacks us, because we, like Job, have created an opening. And God will allow Satan to enter it by permission. And Satan is only too eager to do that. Let me make a statement. Satan is not to be tinkered with like an old broken watch, brethren. He is not a being to spend time with at all. Sometimes people bring up questions about demons or the devil. What is he like? What he does, this or that or the other, and they have questions. And he is not to be trifled with. He is a powerful, brilliant, dangerous being who is far, far more cunning than we would ever realize. I don't say that just because I've dealt with a few demons. Your Bible makes that very plain. Now, we were talking the other day here in the office. Hope none of you are upset when I say this, but you know, I rarely won't be upset by this, but what I'm going to say in a minute, hope nobody is anyway, but I rarely ever watch about 90% of the different types of programs that are on television. I just don't. If you want to know what kind of television I watch, virtually exclusively, it's the news or sports and occasionally a movie. There are exceptions that probably amount to maybe 3% of the time. I don't think there's any way it could be 10% of the time. Maybe 3% of the time I watch some other kind of program. I don't ever watch the sitcoms. I don't ever watch the serial shows. I haven't seen a soap opera probably since the third grade, other than if I'm sitting waiting to pick up my car and it's on in the waiting room and I realize 35 years later, didn't miss a thing. Just exactly what I remember when my mother was feeding me chicken soup because I had the flu in 1958 or whatever it was. I don't watch any of that. I just never do. Now, I know there's lots of new programs. I'm not interested in How to Marry a Millionaire. I'm not interested in watching the show called Greed. I'm not interested in seeing people who are millionaires watch women or men or whatever it is. I haven't seen it. I mean, I saw a few minutes of it the other day, and I've read plenty about it in the newspapers, and it's sweeping the country. But I don't care to watch women compete to marry a man on television moments after they laid eyes on him. It's sick. I just don't watch it. Now, there's a program called The X-Files. I'd heard so much about it for years that the other day I decided to watch it once. I there's Generation X out there, and I call that program Generation X-Files because it's Generation X that loves it. I watched it once. I guarantee you I'll never watch it again. I'm told it's bizarre, it's twisted, it's aliens, it's monsters, it's all kinds of sick stuff. But I thought, I'm going to watch it once. I'm going to see what it's like. I think part of watching is to at least be a little bit aware of what's out there. Let me tell you what the program was about. It was about the devil. Now, it started out in Tennessee. There was this group of snake handlers. And this guy was found in a car, bitten 127 times, I think, by deadly rattlesnakes. You know, there are people who handle deadly creatures, you know, deadly snakes. I read about a guy named Roscoe Pack one time who lived in Tennessee, and he was his obituary. He died because he was handling a snake at a church service to prove that, he would not die if he was bitten by a deadly thing, quoting Christ. Well, so they tempt God, and these people handle snakes, and they bite them, and then you're supposed to survive if you have faith. Well, Roscoe Pack didn't. He's no relative, I'll just tell you that. But this show was about that kind of mindset, and it also took place in Tennessee. And there was a preacher who was, I think it was called Church of God. I believe it was Church of God. And he was a fire and brimstone, wrath of God in all of his sermons. And his daughter, I believe it was, went off and married some kid who attended, I may not have all the details, I'm not remembering, it's been a few weeks, but married some kid who was in plain old ordinary Protestant church. And it had a nice, calm minister who was leading it, very Protestant. You had the two different ministers, and they were battling. The Pentecostal minister at the Church of God wanted his daughter back. And, she was pregnant, and then the story developed, and the X-File stars kind of did an investigation. How was it a guy could be found in a closed car locked with 127 snake bites, and there were no snakes in the car? Well, of course, the idea was Satan had come into his life, and the whole story developed in such a way that Satan had, in fact, a part of this Pentecostal church where they believed in miracles and all kinds of other things. And you saw snakes all through the program. Now, here's what happened. They set you up believing that the devil was in the Pentecostal church where they talk about him and fire and brimstone sermons. And at a certain point in time, this girl gave birth later on to a whole bunch of little snakes. Obviously, she had been impregnated by the devil himself. This is sick stuff, but millions and millions of human beings watch it. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And it flashed back and forth, by the way, at two different points there together, two different views in the churches. And each one of them were quoting from the book of Revelation about the church in Laodicea and how they were lukewarm. We're talking about lukewarmness. It was so vile, so sick, and eventually the Protestant minister, it did a twist, the Protestant minister was the devil and snakes came out of him, and it was horrendous. And I turned off the television so stunned at what millions of people are taking into their heads with no idea whatsoever how cunning the devil was. As a matter of fact, the greatest illustration of his cunning is the way the scriptwriters in Hollywood kept you guessing and kept your head dancing with what was going on, because nothing was as it seemed all through the program. Was the devil here? Was he there? Was he in this person? Was he in that person? Snakes would come out of them. Snakes would come out of the wall. People would die, get bitten. You know, this one thing that was to pull staples out. You know what one of those things are? It has four teeth, and they pull a staple out. All of a sudden, it became fangs of a snake, jumped out of a woman's hand and bit her, and she died while she was doing church work. And you didn't know until the very last scene who the devil was, because he had everybody fooled. Satan is not to be trifled with. There are more and more programs. There's a program out there called channeling. That's a new program that's coming. Maybe it's already started, where now there are going to be professionals who will help people talk to the spirits of the dead. Well, you know, the dead know not anything. When a man dies, and that very day his thoughts perish. Anybody who's talking from the grave is not a person, it's a demon. So now the whole country is going to be taught to channel, to talk to demons. And then, of course, there's Touched by an Angel. And how many other programs, like the movie Michael, about this degenerate angel? John Travolta played the part. There's so many programs about the supernatural and extraterrestrials, and I can't even name them all. And people watch them constantly, and the whole world is being geared up to evermore invite this being into their life, or if you will, and I want to go through some points, they are beginning to fulfill Ephesians chapter 4. Let's look at the verse 27, Ephesians 4 again. Your Bible may still be open there. It says, neither give place to the devil. Now the context is wrath and anger. That's a way to give place to the devil. The word for place is fascinating. It's fascinating. You know me, I love to study words. The Greek word is topos, T-O-P-O-S, from which comes the word, by the way, topography. You all know what topography is. Topography is the lay of the land. If you have a topographical map, which comes from topos, you have a map that doesn't just show roads, but it shows mountains, rivers, valleys, hills, you know, flat lands, and you see the topography of the land, the shape of the land. Cruise missiles have the topography that they're going to fly over built into their computer guidance system, because they hug the earth and they have to know the topography out ahead of them. They can read the topography and fly. There are people who are topographers. They make topographical maps. So the word topos, with that connection, is interesting in itself. But it literally means a location. This word place means a location, a spot, a space, limited by occupancy. Now, when it says don't give place to the devil, it means don't give him literally what it means, a space, a location, a spot that he can occupy, a limited space he can come in and occupy. In other words, if you want to put it another way, don't give him any topography in your life where he can come in and settle in. You can do that, or you can resist it. Don't give place. Don't give any topos to him. So I want to give you some points in the balance of the sermon here. And this is really number one about the devil. Ephesians 4:26 and 7, point one is, do not give place to the devil. You parents out there, shut that garbage off of your televisions. Don't let your kids watch it. It's dangerous. It's wrong. And it's far more of a problem than it appears to be. Oh, it's just harmless, mom and dad. I don't care. You know, I'm not hung up on it. They have no idea to whom they are giving place when they watch those kinds of sick, twisted shows. Now, it isn't just about don't give him place that way. Obviously, if you're angry, you're giving him place. You are opening yourself up. Bitterness. Who is the accuser of the brethren? If somebody gets into a strongly accusative attitude, they are absolutely opening their mind up to the mind out there that just fits naturally right into that kind of a mindset. There are people out there who accuse all the time. It's the way they think. And somehow they think they do God's service because they're accusing on God's behalf, I guess. And that's the way they think. Lucifer was a brilliant being. Meant light bringer. Brilliant. He was, you could say, among spirit beings, perhaps, that he was a genius. I had a next-door neighbor by the name of Stevie Moyer. He was absolutely brilliant. He was so gifted that they tested him and determined that he was ready for college in the seventh grade. I grew up around him. He was one of the oddest little kids, except for this one little detail. He had 184 IQ. That's higher than Norman Schwarzkopf, who's 178. That's an incredible, brilliant genius. He would be on the television shows. His father was the mayor of Lima, Ohio, and he lived right next door to me. And he couldn't function with anybody. He would get out of bed. He was so brilliant, and I'm going to give you the point of this in a moment, but he was so brilliant, he'd get out of bed, and he'd put on his shirt, and that's all he'd put on, his top shirt, nothing else. And he'd answer the door like that. He was so far away in Never Never Land, he could do unbelievable calculus in the fifth grade, just stuff that we couldn't even relate to him. And everybody made fun of him. But he was brilliant, and he was odd. And when he was 17, he blew his brains out. At Harvard. They accepted him when he was 15 years old. He was studying to be a brain surgeon, and he did surgery on his own brains with a gun. It's a sad, sad story. But I've often looked down through history, the most brilliant people often are odd. They're strange, because the devil identifies with them. He thinks that way, and he looks for brilliance, because he's a brilliant being. You know, Edgar Allan Poe was incredibly brilliant. Look at what he wrote. You look at so many of the gifted geniuses down through time. I've studied a lot of the greatest thinkers and philosophers. They had brilliant minds, and their lives were scrambled. You could tell that the sniper had gotten into their life. Because Satan is a sniper. He can fire bullets with tremendous precision from great distance and just flat out take people out. He's very, very good at what he does. So point number one is very simply, God says don't give him place. Don't do it with your TV set. Don't read books. You know, don't listen to stories. Don't get into Ouija boards or other stuff. Just don't do it. 2 Corinthians chapter 2. 2 Corinthians chapter 2. Point 2. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, and we'll pick it up in about verse 7. The devil is going to grow far more powerful. He's going to be far more evident and involved in what happens in the world around us. The whole world is moving toward a need to see miracles. And at the right moment, there will be not just one, but the Bible says a lot of people only too willing to accommodate them with miracles. It's one of the dangers of not believing that Elijah has already come in our lifetime, but that he is somehow still going to come. And when he does, he'll do powerful miracles like the Elijah of the Old Testament rather than the Elijah of the New Testament, John the Baptist, who did none, not one. It's one of the dangers for God's people. It's why Christ warned not to look for that stuff. There are leaders out there who are talking about how they want to see miracles in the church. I was around one of them a lot. It's a dangerous mindset because there are going to be a lot of miracles coming, and they're not the kind you're going to want to see, but they're going to be the kind that dazzle a lot of people because the great miracle worker himself will bring them, and he'll eventually bring them through one person in a powerful an amazing way. And the world is being conditioned for it now through television, movies, books, and so forth. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 7. So the contrarywise, you ought rather to forgive him and comfort him, this person who had been put out of the church in the first book, chapter 5, first epistle rather. Paul had told him to put this fellow out. Forgive him, comfort him, lest perhaps such a one should be swallowed up with overmuch sorrow. Wherefore I beseech you that you would confirm your love toward him. For to this end also did I write, that I might know the proof of you, whether you be obedient in all things. To whom you forgive anything, I forgive also. For if I forgave anything, to whom I forgave it. For your sakes forgave I it in the person of Christ. I did it on Christ's behalf for your sake, lest Satan should get an advantage of us. For we are not ignorant of his devices, literally his strategy. Now, just look at verse 11. One of the things, brethren, we are doing in the restored church of God is we're trying to simply look at the Bible for exactly what it says. One of the greatest qualities of the man who taught me the truth is he showed me what was always in this book, but nobody ever seemed to pay attention to it. The things were just so clear when you saw them. So, a Christian is one who looks at the Bible and sees it for exactly what it says and accepts it. He doesn't try to reason around it. Now, this verse simply says Satan can get an advantage of you. You've seen people take advantage of other people. I've been taken advantage of. I'm sure you have. I've seen people be taken advantage of. It's going to happen. But what you don't want to happen is for Satan to take advantage of you. That's exactly what the verse is about. Don't let Satan take advantage of you. You know, it's a war. We'll see that more later. It's a war. But the way you don't let him take advantage of you is you know what his devices are. Well, what are his devices? There's a whole lot of them. He works a certain way. We already heard anger. An unforgiving attitude. Right, there's the context. If you don't forgive other people, you are setting yourself up potentially for bitterness, which would be another one. Discouragement. Pride. We'll see that later on. Rebellion. Well, who's the greatest rebel the universe has ever seen? And took hundreds of millions of angels with him. The devil. A promiscuous mind is always wide open. They're just promiscuous. The devil's mind is wide open. It knows no barriers. It has no stop signs in it. A lot of people spend their life just running through life's stop signs. They're very promiscuous with their life. Not just sexually promiscuous, that's one way, but other ways. They just, whatever they want, they just take it. A discontented attitude, covetous attitude, a critical attitude, a disobedient attitude, an accusative attitude we've already talked about if you're writing these down, and so forth. A divisive, a doubting attitude. Don't be ignorant of his devices. Now, it says, for we are not ignorant of his devices. Are you? Are you ignorant? To ignore something is to be without knowledge. You're either knowledgeable or unknowledgeable, which is the same as ignorance. Call somebody ignorant. You're really not calling them stupid. Well, you're just ignorant. You know, people say, oh, he's just ignorant. It's like you're calling him stupid. That's not what the word means. The word ignorant can be true of somebody who is brilliant, frankly. It means they're without knowledge. If we ignore his devices, then he'll take advantage. And we will, in fact, give him place. So you have to be well informed. Remember, the priests, at the time Christ came for the first time, taught there were two things that people never needed to hear about. They never needed to hear about sex, and they never needed to hear about demons, because what they didn't know couldn't hurt them. And that's why when Christ came, the Jewish community was shot full of sex and demon problems. Because what they didn't know could hurt them. But that was the approach of the priest. Don't talk about it, don't say anything. And so a lot of people were ignorant of his devices. And it's why you find Christ sent them out to cast out demons. And he dealt constantly with sex problems. People, when they're ignorant, get into problems. This sermon is about eliminating a kind of ignorance. Educators out there are trying to eliminate ignorance in this country. An awful lot of people can't read and write. It's astonishing what you find is the level of understanding of a lot of Americans. It's just incredible. But a lot of people are willingly ignorant. You know, there's an old saying, ignorance of the law is no excuse. You have to know the law. That's actually a court finding. You can't say, well, I didn't know the law. Oh, well, you're off the hook. No, ignorance of the law is no excuse. Well, ignorance of the way Satan functions is no excuse. Number three, back to Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians 2. Just some basic things in our understanding of the devil that we need to get back to. One of the reasons, brethren, one of the first booklets we published by Mr. Armstrong is Did God Create a Devil? Is I just honestly believe a lot of God's people forgot it. They just flat out forgot that there's a devil out there and he deceives the whole world. So there was a reason why we picked that book. You might say, well, all the booklets that we picked of Mr. Armstrong, why did you pick that one among the first four to publish? Well, now you know the reason. I just think a great many people have forgotten the power of this great being. Ephesians 2:2. Wherein in time past you walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in the children of disobedience. You know, plain disobedience is one of Satan's devices. Satan wants to make people disobedient. Here's his Dennis Rodman back in the NBA again. He's going to be a good boy. He's coming back, age almost 39. And after two games, he's expelled and suspended from the league for the 24th time. Why do they let him come back? 24 times suspended? Incredible. So he's out for a game. But there is this prince of the power of the air who broadcasts. Remember hearing about that understanding? It's like he has a radio broadcast. Very basic. He broadcasts, and people can give him place, and they can give him an advantage. He's already got an advantage by virtue of the fact that he's far more brilliant and far stronger than we are. Never forget the book of Acts. You don't have to turn there. Acts 19, where the sons of Sceva went in to cast out this demon, seven of them, one guy with a demon. And most people just don't understand how powerful a demon is. I've seen them. They can take over little people and just absolutely knock doors down, crush walls. I've watched them. And seven men fled out of this house because one guy stripped them all naked. They fled naked, nude. Go read Acts 19. I doubt the seven sons of Sceva, S-C-E-V-A was his name, went in messing where they didn't belong, that is with demons, ever again. The prince of the power of the air has power that accompanies him, that he uses through the air. 2 Corinthians 4:4, he is the God of this world. He is the God of the world. And Revelation 12:9, basic verses. He has deceived the whole world. People seem unable to understand that. He has power to broadcast. And unless you dial him out, then you've let him in. You've given him place in your mind because his broadcast is out there. You turn on a radio, you decide what station it's going to come into your car. The fact that you do not allow certain stations in doesn't mean they're not broadcasting to other places. But you can make that decision. The broadcast is out there, but you either let it in or you don't. Number four. Oh, I wanted to turn to Luke chapter 4 first for a moment. Luke chapter 4. Then we'll go to point number 4. But first, Luke chapter 4. In this famous confrontation between Satan and Christ when he showed him the kingdoms of the world. The devil took him up, verse 5, to a high mountain and showed unto him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. Now, I don't know how you do that, except it was a supernatural event, clearly. How do you see all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time? And the devil said to him, all this power will I give you and the glory of them, for that is delivered unto me, and to whomsoever I will, I give it. Now, you'll notice that Christ did not say, when he said, just worship me and it'll all be yours, Christ didn't say, hey, it's not yours to give. Christ didn't say, no, you're wrong. It's not yours. It's mine, because the kingdoms of the world are the devil's. They are the devil's. They were not Christ's. And Christ didn't obviously agree to the terms of the contract that he was being offered, and so he was not, you know, he was not fooled, and an agreement never took place. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Says in verse 5, defraud you not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer. And come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. Well, it's talking to husbands and wives. Be sure that you don't abstain too long, or you create a problem for yourselves. So let's just be very blunt. Sex is everywhere out there. And Satan will tempt through sex. Satan cannot enjoy sex, so he often will push people or try to get into bodies so he can sort of have an experience that way, since it's not something God has ever offered him. The angels are not given in marriage. Very plain. Satan can tempt people sexually. Real plain. That's what he can do. And it says that Satan tempt you not. So adultery, sex, and every other kind of pornography and the garbage that's on television again, every so often I'll dial in for a minute or two and listen to a program, not very long, it's all I can stand. And it, you don't need more than 1 to 2 minutes on almost any of these programs and you heard a sex joke, a put-down joke. It's just simply everywhere. Number 5. Turn to Acts 5. Turn to Acts chapter 5. And verse 1. A certain man named Ananias with Sapphira, his wife, sold a possession. All right, you know the story. But let's notice something that maybe we have not noticed before. Kept back part of the price. His wife also being privy to it, brought a certain part, laid it at the apostles' feet. But Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Spirit and to keep back part of the price of the land? Did you catch that? Why has Satan filled your heart to lie? Just take the verse for exactly what it says. These two human beings literally allowed the devil to come in and fill them up with himself. Now, the devil always does two things, ultimately. Everything the devil ever does are toward two specific ends, to kill and to lie. And if he can't kill people literally, he will kill the truth in their heart through lies, whether it's lies that are told or lies that are taught doctrinally. But he can fill people's minds. Do you believe that? Do you believe that the devil can get into hearts and minds and literally fill them up? You know, there's no evidence, in the way I wish there was, but there's no evidence. You can surmise some things that are kind of interesting, that Ananias and Sapphira were particularly bad people. They were apparently part of the church. Were they tares? There's no, that doesn't say they were. They certainly denied the Spirit of God. Did they just deny it in Peter when he was talking with them, or did they deny it in themselves because they were in fact converted people? They certainly were giving a great deal of money. Now, they weren't giving all of it, and that was the problem. But there's no evidence they were particularly bad people. They fell into a desperately wrong attitude, and it flat out destroyed them because they allowed the devil to come into their heart. Now, you might stop and consider, there's another point here that's interesting. A husband and wife together did it. It involved a conspiracy. People can conspire together. They can agree together and not, in some cases, will one person even stand up and say, no, we can't do that. We can't conspire together. A conspiracy can grow in numbers of people. I don't know what happened in the L.A. Police Department, but there was actually a conspiracy, apparently, so say many of the facts that are coming out, to put away a lot of people, to frame people. Dozens and scores of people, it appears, are going to be released from prison. Just today's paper talked about how the millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in lawsuits are going to be paid out. And basically, Los Angeles is probably going to have to pay its share of the money that comes from the tobacco companies and the winning of that lawsuit. And they're going to wind up having to pay it to all these people who were falsely jailed because people get together and conspire. The Bible talks about conspiracies. Absalom conspired against David. People can get together and conspire. Husbands and wives can do it. And if somebody doesn't stop and say, no, this is wrong, hearts get filled up with wrong thoughts that can destroy the conspirers thereof, so to speak. Satan can fill people's hearts. Turn to Colossians 3. Colossians 3 and verse 9. Says, lie not one to another, seeing that you have put off the old man with his deeds. Well, people who have God's Spirit can tell lies. It wouldn't say, lie not, if you put off the old man, if you couldn't be a Christian who has put off the old man but is still capable of telling lies. That's just very basic. It's one reason why I think Ananias and Sapphira may have been converted. I don't know. I'm not their judge. I don't know. But the point is, they were in the church, whether they were in the body of Christ, only God knows, but they were absolutely oblivious to the terrible danger of this being whose devices they forgot, and he filled them up, and they lost their lives. The only good that came out of it is that a lot of people, it says, grew in the fear of God, because, you know, you watch a couple people fall dead right there in front of the apostles, that'll get your attention every time, so to speak. Number 6 came up in last week's sermon. Turn to 1 Timothy chapter 4. 1 Timothy chapter 4. Now keep in mind, once again, the devil is a sniper. He's a real sniper. You know, people talk about going snipe hunting. Snipes don't exist. I was a little kid, you know. I had a much older male cousin-in-law, I guess he was sort of like a step-cousin, rather, not in-law, but step-cousin. And he, you know, told me how there were snipes out there and take me snipe hunting. And, well, there are no such thing as snipes, but they're very, you know, they much are snipers. He was actually a captain in Vietnam, and he told me some remarkable stories later on about some of his experiences and various weapons that were used there. 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 1. The sniper uses this weapon. He will fire bullets at people through sex. He will fire it through anger. He will fire it with an unforgiving attitude. He can fire it with a disobedient attitude, a rebellious attitude, a critical or an accusative attitude. Those are all just bullets that the devil fires. But in 1 Timothy 4, it says, now the Spirit speaks expressly that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons. The devil is a god. Gods have doctrines. You know, all gods have doctrines. I don't care if it's Shinto, Tao, you know, Buddha, Allah, or any other god you want to name. You know, the Greeks had 30,000 gods. Hindus have 5 million gods. Gods have doctrines. Satan's no different. It's just that his doctrines, he has learned, if he's really going to be good at what he does, ought to at least in part parallel and shadow, or if you will, counterfeit the doctrines of God, because people can slip into them more easily while thinking they're holding fast because they're lookalikes. You've heard it said many times, any counterfeit that's going to be passed successfully at a, you know, 7-Eleven has got to look like the real McCoy. It's got to look like a $20 bill to be passed as a $20 bill. It used to be $10,000 bills, $1,000 bills, $500 bills. Maybe there were $5,000 bills. I'm not sure. And I know there were $500 bills and so forth. There were the 500s, and now they stopped. There are only hundreds because people can counterfeit the bigger bills and do a lot more damage than they can with a 5, 10, or a 20. And there are other reasons, too. So the great counterfeiter counterfeits doctrine, and he does it very successfully. 2 Corinthians 11, 2 Corinthians chapter 11, 13 to 15. It's fascinating watching this X-File program. I'll never watch it again, never watched it before, but it was an experience I won't forget because it illustrates this verse, 2 Corinthians 11, 13. For such are false workers, apostles rather, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. This Protestant minister just had so much love and understanding until the moment in the movie when he opened his mouth, out came a snake, and he fed it a mouse to close the movie or the show. Incredible, but he looked wonderful. I mean, Hollywood knows more about what they're doing than you might ever believe. You cannot depict that world that accurately from outside it. Do you understand what I'm saying? They're in it. Not just because the prince of the power of the air is throwing a few thoughts their way and they're picking up on it and making TV shows like Touched by an Angel, Channeling, or other stuff. X-Files, and who knows how many others. I wrote the titles down one time, probably should have brought them up here. They're so accurate, they're so incredible, they're so cunning that the authors are speaking from inside Satanism. No, I don't say they're Satan worshipers. I don't know. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of life. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their works. People are impressed by people. They're impressed by how beautiful people are. I'll tell you right now, in the restored Church of God, we had better understand most of the beautiful people are not going to come here. I'm sure not one of them. Most of us are not the beautiful people. The beautiful people need beautiful settings. They need beautiful socials. I love wonderful socials. Don't misunderstand me. But they need to be where other beautiful people are. And maybe where the beautiful ministers are. You know, they want to rub shoulders with the spiritual rich and famous. That's not us. You will find that a lot of the people who come with us are far from, you know, the golden pretty boy and woman type. We are not the beautiful people. Christ was not beautiful. So says the book of Isaiah. He was a rather average-looking person. When Christ walked by, you didn't say, wow, there goes Ricky Martin or Tom Selleck or somebody. No, he could slip through a crowd, and where'd he go? He just looked like everybody else. Didn't look like Clint Eastwood. And we're going to be less than the beautiful people. When somebody comes across as a little too smooth, a little too beautiful, attractive, then I'm a little more wary. I'm a lot more wary. And for people who are not looking past that stuff, who are impressed by countenance, they get taken in. They just simply get taken in. Matthew 13. Matthew chapter 13. Point 7. That was point 6. Doctrines of demons seduce people. That's what it says. They were seduced by doctrines of demons. Well, you know what a sexual seduction is, by man or woman of the opposite sex, or you know, the same sex. People try to seduce people of the same sex as well. You know what a seduction is, sexually. The same is true doctrinally. The difference between a doctrinal and a sexual seduction is about zero. You have to get people to go along with something that's wrong. Matthew chapter 13 and verse 3. Then he spoke many things unto them in parables, saying, Behold, a sower went forth to sow. And when he sowed, some seeds fell by the wayside, and the fowls came and devoured them up. Some fell upon stony places. Verse 7, some fell among thorns. Verse 8, some other fell among good ground, and so forth. So it's the famous parable of the sower. Well, let's go to verse 18. Now hear you therefore the parable of the sower. This is what it means. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and understands it not, then comes the wicked one and catches away that which was sown in his heart. Do you realize, brethren, that the devil can come into a heart, a mind, and snatch the right seed out, can snatch a doctrine out? Do you believe that verse? Do you believe he can go right into minds and snatch out right doctrines? He can. Absolutely, he can do it. This is he which received seed by the wayside. There is a wicked one who can enter hearts. Look at a number of verses that show that. He can pull truths right out of the mind. That's why I am so utterly committed, come fire, hail, wind, storm, hell or high water, proverbially speaking, we are going to offer that truth out there again. Yeah, there may be people who try to stop us. I don't care. People tried to stop Mr. Armstrong. Not everybody wants the truth back again. A lot of truths have been plucked from people's minds because they didn't have a firm enough grip on it. So recognize that the Word of God can get plucked right out of your mind. That's what it says. Point 8, last point, Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. A lot of fire and brimstone preachers talk about that wily old serpent. But he really is a wily serpent. The wiles of the devil, his strategy, his tactics, his devices, his wiles, far more brilliant than any human being, and without the power of God in a human mind, you can't defeat him. You just cannot defeat him. Why do you do that? Why do you put on the whole armor of God? Here's why. Because we're not wrestling against flesh and blood. You know, it took me a long time to understand who's behind certain things. You can see the people and think you're wrestling against people. You know, you got each other in this half Nelson, you know, this bear hug, this headlock, whatever it is, and think that's who you're wrestling against, you know, proverbially speaking. Not that we physically wrestle with people, but we're not wrestling against people. People may come and attack us, but that's not who we're wrestling with. But against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against, and it's correctly translated, wicked spirits, there in the margin, in high places, a lot higher than human beings. Wherefore, or because of this, take unto you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. And having done all, to stand. There's an awful lot in the Bible. Could be a whole sermon on just standing there. How many times you read stand? There it is in verse 11. Verse 13 says, withstand. There it is, stand. Verse 14, stand therefore, having your loins girt about with truth. So it can't be plucked from your mind. Having on the breastplate of righteousness, and your feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking the shield of faith. Might be publishing that one soon. Wherewith you shall be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked. The booklet, What is Faith? Actually, there was another one. What kind of faith is required for salvation? Which I think may have gotten merged into it. A lot of people have just forgotten what it means to believe God. One of the things we better believe from God is that there is a God of this world, and he is wily, and you don't want to give him place. When Paul talked about the depth of Satan, Satan has a deep mind. He has great depth to him. He doesn't have any depth of character. He has tremendous depth of knowledge. He has a lot of gimmicks, a lot of wiles, a lot of cunning, a lot of strategy, a lot of devices. And we cannot be ignorant of them. Above all, taking the shield of faith, wherewith you shall be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked. People who sit and attack us. Now, the letter came out, 12-page letter from a lady, picking through my sermons, and then mistyping, misunderstanding, decontextualizing, and having me saying things I don't remotely believe, and firing fiery darts. Came out this week from a lady, and she just knows she's serving God, sitting hovered over computer and tape recorder and extracting things, juxtaposing things, and I do slip. I say things that are wrong. I do say things backward. Didn't mean to say that. I said things that are wrong in my sermons that I didn't mean to say, as I've alluded to before. This lady wants to show that one of my sermons, I believe that Michael and Gabriel rebelled. And it sounds like on one of my tapes I sort of said that, because I was mixing things in a long thought train. Sometimes I do. As I've said earlier, if Moses stuttered, and he knew it, I can certainly stutter in terms of thoughts. A little bit of dyslexia, as I have mentioned before, just a touch. I'll say things wrong I don't mean to say. There are people in heaven, or apparently in one sermon I supposedly said the earth is the universe. At least that's what she typed. I think I said the earth and the universe, but she typed it the other way. And who's going to go back? And I guess that makes me a heretic. That I could be so dumb, brethren, is to try to teach a heresy that the earth is the universe and think that anybody, including my wife, would follow me is ludicrous, but that's one of the heresies she accuses me of. People will throw fiery darts to cast doubts. I remember at college being taught, if you want to just translate the word darts into a word that'll help you understand what it's talking about, it's doubts. What are the things that go against faith? Faith is deep belief. What's the opposite of that? It's doubt. Doubt is probably one of the greatest devices of the sniper, who can kill from great distance if he can fire a dart of doubt dead on. People can doubt all kinds of things. They can doubt their conversion. They can doubt motives of others. And even doubt their own motives when they have somebody planting a seed in their mind. They can doubt the government of God. They can doubt God's purpose. They can doubt doctrine. Fiery darts can doubt anything. And if you do not have great faith as a shield around you, then the darts will enter. The doubts will enter. We're going to have people attack us. I know you hear me say that. I just wonder if you believe it, brethren. There may be a struggle or various struggles ahead of us that you would not believe. We'll just see. We'll see. couple final verses after those 8 points. James chapter 4. I hope you have a healthy respect, brethren, for the power of this being who wants you dead. Seduced first and then dead. James 4 and verse 7. Verse 6, we'll pick it up. But God gives more grace, wherefore he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace unto the humble. Pride is a devastating thing to let enter your mind. Just devastating. The devil is the proudest being in the universe. You read in Ezekiel and Isaiah, he was apparently a beautiful being. He was one of the beautiful people. I'm not calling him people. But he's one of the beautiful people, so to speak. An angel of light. And God cannot work where there's pride. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil. And that's how you submit. Or that's how you resist the devil. You submit to God. You submit to God, and he will flee from you. The devil will flee from you if you submit to God. And you submit by humbling yourself. This woman tried to say that I said that God cannot humble people. I'm sorry, I did say that. The Bible is filled with humble yourself. If God could impute humility into people, he could impute character. And if there's one thing I understood Mr. Armstrong to say 1,000 times is God cannot impute character. And humility is a character, is character. That's why it says, humble yourselves. Oh, she just thought I was preaching heresy, and she turned to one verse and didn't fully understand a mistranslation. And throughout all the other verses where the Bible says, humble yourself under the mighty hand of God. Humble yourself. And overlooked it. Verse 10, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord. It is not something he will do for you. Job could have resisted God abasing him. God can abase people, whether it's Job or Nebuchadnezzar. God can abase anybody. But he cannot take pride out of their heart unless they submit themselves to God and resist the devil and he flees. And they humble themselves. 1 Peter chapter 5, final verse. Verse 5, likewise, you younger, submit yourselves unto the elder. Yes, all of you be subject one to another and be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Here it is, ready? Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God. You can't find a place where God will do it for you. It's a choice in the mind to lower yourself and submit to God, and the devil can't work there. In a mind that is submitted to God, that he may exalt you in due time. Cast all your cares upon him, for he cares for you. Why do you do this? Same context there as James 4. Be sober, vigilant. Brethren, will you? Will we? Will all of you hearing this tape be sober and vigilant? Why? Because your adversary, the devil, not people, your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour. What do? Whom resist steadfast in the faith. In the faith, you don't allow doubts in. There are going to be tremendous attacks on our beliefs through doubts, to create doubt, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world. In other words, everybody goes through these same trials, these same difficulties, these same attacks. So humble yourself and resist the devil steadfastly. That means continue and continue and continue and continue and continue. You don't do it off and on and off and on. But the God of all grace, who has called us unto his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after that you have suffered a while, make you perfect and establish and strengthen and settle you. Brethren, there is a great sniper out there, and I guess he's got the ultimate high-powered weapon. He's got his spirit, and he can shoot it, fire it, anywhere in the world, in all kinds of forms and ways, in a completely unexpected fashion. Just like the enemy soldier who thinks he's walking safely across an open space and has no idea the 300 or 800 or 1,000 yards away, a sniper is sitting in a tree about to end his life with the squeezing of a trigger, so also is the devil waiting to take you and I out. Out of God's way. I'd like to insert a point here that could have easily been a part of the One True Church series where I spoke of the question in Corinthians, is Christ divided? Christ is not divided. It was a rhetorical question. But you'll recall his famous statement in the book of Matthew when he was speaking about Satan's kingdom. He said, "No kingdom divided of itself shall stand." Certainly the devil's kingdom cannot be divided, or he knows it would collapse. Now somehow people think the church, well, you know, it can be divided, and the seventh era is divided, and it's not standing as a result. But consider, it's clear we all know if a football team's divided, pro football team, it's not going to win the Super Bowl. If a professional hockey team is divided, it won't win the Stanley Cup. A Major League Baseball team is divided, we all understand it will not win the World Series. A family divided will not stand. A kingdom or a country of this world divided will not stand. The devil's kingdom, if it's divided, will not stand. But somehow the most important entity to Christ in the universe, that being the body of Christ, his church, oh, no problems. My church, it can be divided. Not a football or basketball or baseball team or a family. And certainly the devil's church, because the devil has his religion, it can't be divided. My church, no problem. Brethren, the devil is the master of divide and conquer. I hope we see through the logic that so many do not see through in how he has divided and conquered much of the church. He wants to divide and conquer the church. And it will grow worse and worse as time goes on. The old adage, you ain't seen nothing yet, applies. When the devil comes down with even greater wrath, he will persecute the church literally all the way to the point where they make it safely to the place of safety, while his army is destroyed in its pursuit, and then he turns on the remnant of the seed. You know Revelation 12:17. We must understand we are in a war. There are casualties in any war. Some are fatalities. The devil, like any good sniper, and he's the greatest sniper of all, who fires spiritual bullets, goes for headshots. He knows if he sends one of his bullets through a Christian's head, he kills them. He doesn't go for a body shot. He wants them dead. And we've talked earlier about the various kinds of bullets that the God of this world, the great sniper, fires from great distances through his spirit. Let us be aware that as time goes on, we must not let the devil divide and conquer the church, or divide and conquer any one individual within the church.